Philip Giraldi is a former CIA counterterrorism specialist and military intelligence officer who served 18 years in Turkey, Italy, Germany, and Spain, and is currently a partner in Catastrero Associates, a security consultancy in McLean, Virginia. He is a regular contributor to antiwar.com, a contributing editor, and writes a deep background column on terrorism, intelligence, and security issues for the American Conservative magazine. He's been interviewed on virtually every major TV network in the U.S. and most of the important ones abroad. And I was happy to have him here on Takes on the World back in February 2008. Welcome once again, Philip Giraldi, to Takes on the World. Hello, Philip?
Yep, I'm here.
Oh, you're there. Very good. Sorry, I put up the wrong slider. at least it's not the wrong trigger. You've been documenting the buildup to a war with Iran for some time, citing information that has been generally ignored by the mainstream media and alternative media as well. In your latest article on antiwar.com website, Timetable for War, you make the case that an Israeli attack is likely and perhaps this August. Please run us through that scenario.
Well, it's basically due to the fact that the United States is changing its status with the government of Iraq. Currently, the United States government controls the airspace over Iraq, and as of September 1st, the Iraqi government will technically be in control of its own airspace. That complicates the issue of a possible Israeli attack after that point, because it would mean a violation of Iraqi airspace that the Iraqis would no doubt complain about and would demand that the United States intervene to protect its airspace. So it would create an impossible situation for the U.S., and I believe that the Israelis will be motivated to stage their attack against Iran before that time.
What else do you see happening that, in terms of the propaganda? You also wrote an article about a week ago about papering the war against Iran. What else do you see building up to this point of Israeli attack?
Well, clearly the U.S. government is trying to get strong sanctions out of the United Nations as a precursor to this. This is, I think, more psychological than practical in terms of creating an atmosphere that Iran is indeed a threat to the world community. So I think that's part of it. But obviously there's a major media campaign going on in places like the Washington Post and the New York Times and on television media. And also there is a lot of stuff going on in Congress in terms of supporting stronger sanctions, including sanctions that contain a military option. So I think that's all the things that we are seeing that's going on. And obviously the White House is not discouraging this process. Hillary Clinton in particular has been using very strong language about Iran.
Well, I know, and before I called you, I mentioned that a letter that was sent on May 3rd by eight leading U.S. senators to their fellow Senator Chuck Chris Dodd and to Howard Berman, urging them to get that conference committee combining the Senate and House versions of very, very tough sanctions that Obama actually was against, to get that onto the floor and passed, and not with reducing in any way providing exemptions for any companies. This was AIPAC has been pushing that, as you've all mentioned it yourself. Is there any other sector in American society that is pushing us for a confrontation with Iran other than the Israel lobby and its friends in the Christian Zionist movement?
Well, I think they're the primary source of the drive for a confrontation with Iran, but of course a lot of it is playing out through Congress and through the friendly media. So, you know, it's very hard to... Still, for me, it's very hard to figure why anyone objectively looking at the situation believes that Iran is a threat against the United States. But to a certain extent, that's the way it's being played. And I'm sure you're aware that there have been opinion polls that have indicated that the American public, by a large majority, believes that Iran already has a nuclear weapon and that Iran is a threat to the world that has to be resolved through the use of military action by the United States.
Are we seeing here again a rerun of what we led up to the build-up to the war in Iraq?
Yeah, I think we are. And the danger, what makes this this lead up particularly dangerous is the fact that Iran is no Iraq, and it's not going to be a cakewalk. It's not going to be American troops landing and marching to Baghdad. The Iranians are quite prepared to resist and resist very effectively, and it's going to have serious consequences if we do resort to military action.
This doesn't seem to bother Israel's supporters or its op-ed pundits. I would suspect even with the U.S. troops out of Iraq or the majority, the green zone already has Iran missiles targeting it.
Yeah, there are 100 things that the Iranians can do to make life extremely difficult for the U.S. forces in Central Asia and the Middle East. And the fact that Petraeus back a couple months ago, as I'm sure you're aware, made comments to the effect that the Palestinian issue was threatening American soldiers, and Biden said basically the same thing, tells you that, you know, there's probably a lot more information that we're not privy to that indicates that the Pentagon is and the White House are seriously worried about what might happen if we actually go to war.
It's interesting, Petraeus, who's being talked about in some circles as a Republican candidate for the next election, immediately came under attack by elements of the Israel lobby, including a collection of former admirals and generals, retired admirals and generals in this organization called JINSA. Maybe you could tell us what JINSA is all about.
Well, JINSA is, I believe it's actually partly funded by AIPAC. It's basically an organization that has a Jew, as the first J is Jewish. It's an organization that has a Jewish spin on security issues. And essentially they are one of these groups that, like WINAP is another one, which are very capable of trotting out a number of individuals to support their position, whatever their position is. But their position is always supportive of Israel.
Yeah, JINSA says Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs. I mean, Dick Cheney used to be on its board, and he was one of their honorees, annual honorees to give awards to the most loyal American official for Israel, that is. One of the things you've mentioned recently, also you wrote about, and influenced, and you brought up Petraeus, is the penetration of Washington into Washington circles of Israelis and very pro-Israel officials, but one particular Israeli former major, Lanny Kass, who is now very high up in the Pentagon next to Mike Mullen, and she was the one who responded to Petraeus. Maybe you could tell us about her.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And for those of you who read antiwar.com, I'm going to have another piece on this subject tomorrow talking about some other individuals. But Lanny Kass was a major in the Israeli Air Force, and apparently was not only in the Air Force, he was an intelligence officer. She came to the United States, married eventually a Pentagon official, and gradually worked her way into the system and made her way to the very top. She's currently the number one civilian advisor to the Chief of Staff for the United States Air Force, a very, very high-level position with access to classified information and to policymaking. And I have questioned in a couple of articles how a person who was a former intelligence officer of a foreign country could possibly get into this kind of position. How did this happen? What was the security, as the government puts it, vetting that took place prior to her getting into this kind of position? I'm not accusing her of being an Israeli spy or anything, but I'm just saying that the potential for something like that to be the case would seem to me to be very high.
Well, at some point, maybe even today, she is director of the program of cyber warfare program of the Air Force. I saw a slide presentation, I think that a link from your article, which showed how she talks about the spread of Islam all over the world. It's a propaganda piece for a war on Islam.
Yeah, she's as you might not be surprised to hear, an extreme hardliner on Islam. And she basically says that Islam is out to establish a worldwide caliphate and convert everybody to Islam. So, you know, she's, you know, this is definitely kind of lunatic fringe in terms of how one looks at the world. And yet she's in an extremely high position in the U.S. government and is, to a certain extent, able to influence policy.
And actually would have the highest of clearances.
Yes, she would, absolutely.
It gets kind of scary. You also mentioned, I believe, that when Petraeus made his took his position that the Israel-Palestine conflict was bad for U.S. interests in the Middle East, she was the one who took the opposite position.
Yeah, this is another interesting aspect of her story. She now is apparently also, in addition to advising the Air Force, is advising Admiral Mike Mullen, who is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And she's apparently his Middle East advisor. And when Petraeus went to Mullen to advise him about his concerns on what was going on with Israel-Palestine, Lanny Cass was the only other person in the room with Mullen. And she was introduced as Mullen's special advisor. And when Petraeus expressed his concerns, Lanny Cass said no, they were much overstated, that none of it was true.
This is actually mind-boggling, but one of the things that I've noticed through the years is there's kind of an open door policy between Israel and the United States that is similar to one between, let's say, the pharmaceutical industry and the people who govern the pharmaceutical industry in Washington. We have Dennis Ross, who before he became back into Washington as a Middle East advisor for the president, was the head of the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs in Jerusalem. What does this all tell you about the situation in Washington and how this country has kind of lost, or at least our government has lost its independence?
Well, I think that the Israelis set out some years ago to basically sell a product, and the product that they tried to sell was that the United States and Israel were joined at the hip and basically had all the same security interests, and everything that Israel wanted was things that were good for America, and so on and so forth. And as a result of 9/11, they've managed to sell this almost 100%, both to Democrats and to Republicans. And this has basically meant that people who are like Dennis Ross, who clearly have been acting, I would throw Martin Indyk and several others also into that pot, acting in terms of Israel's interests, have been sort of presented as people that are good American patriots that are actually doing these things for the United States. But, you know, this argument has been getting a little bit thin, and I think it's utterly transparent now when obviously you're going to get people like Ross arguing in favor of Israeli policy.
Well, it's interesting. There's one man in the Treasury Department and his assistant, Stuart Levy and David Cohen, who are responsible for levying sanctions on companies and ferreting out what companies are doing business with Iran. And Levy regularly speaks before pro-Israeli audiences and brags about what he's doing. And of course, the mainstream media does not cover this.
Levy, before he got, now he's in charge of terrorist financing, which is what gives him his leverage to do that. But before that, he was the Nazi hunter, wasn't he, at the...
That was Neil Scherer.
Ah, okay.
He's also in there, too. There are a half a dozen. I keep finding them all the time, and they're all in top positions, National Security Council, all throughout Washington.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's unfortunately the reality. I mean, the people that quite shamelessly feel that their loyalty, if you want to put it that way, is to another country, and I think that's unfortunate. They've gotten away with it, but I hope that these things turn around, and I think the pendulum will eventually swing. I think that as much as the Israel firsters really want to see a war with Iran, I think it would be their undoing. I think a war with Iran would be such a disaster for the United States that finally people will begin to ask, well, how did this happen?
I agree, but it would be a terrible price to pay. My guess is Philip Giraldi. You mentioned in a previous paper on papering warfare Iran the importance of national intelligence estimate and the case of Charles Freeman, who is a veteran Foreign Service officer who was appointed initially by President Obama to be the head of the National Intelligence Estimate, director of that. And he was initially immediately challenged by pro-Israel attack dogs in the media, and withdrew his nomination, but without going quietly in the night. Maybe you could talk about the importance of the National Intelligence Estimate and Freeman being forced off of that.
Yeah, Freeman was supposed to be the head of the National Intelligence Council, which is the which is kind of the watchdog group that initiates the National Intelligence Estimates, and then kind of processes them at the end before they're released. So it's a very important position because it prioritizes what are key problems that the United States government should be looking at. We've been waiting a couple years for an update on the 2007 National Intelligence Estimate on Iran, because that estimate said that basically Iran had abandoned its nuclear weapons program in 2003. Why we've been waiting is because the White House essentially would like to see something that kind of unties its hands on this issue and says something different, says that Iran continues to be a threat and so on and so forth. The NIE is important because it represents the collective view of all 16 U.S. government intelligence agencies. It is a very, very thorough document and very, very exhaustively prepared. So that's why it's important. And the problem is that the analysts who are working on it can't come up with the conclusion that the White House wants. They can't find any evidence that Iran has a nuclear weapons program. And certainly if Charles Freeman had been on the NIC, he would be arguing very forcibly to the White House that, hey, the facts just don't support this. But as it exists now, this document has been delayed at least three times that I know of, because the White House is looking for the right answer.
Well, Dennis Blair, who was appointed, and obviously is less combative than Freeman, still, evidently, as you write, has not changed his essential position, that there's no evidence that Iran has begun to develop a nuclear weapon, that the possibility exists that they can, but there's no evidence that they have.
Well, you know, this is the funny thing about these arguments about Iran. They keep shifting. The original argument about Iran was that Iran should not be allowed to get a nuclear weapon. And then it was shifted to Iran should not be allowed to enrich nuclear fuel, because if they can enrich nuclear fuel, then eventually they can get a nuclear weapon. This is the same process. Dennis Blair knows that there is no evidence that Iran has a nuclear weapon or has a nuclear weapons program. But what he's saying now is, yeah, we know that, but they can change. This is an autocratic government that they could change their mind and change direction on moment's notice. So this has become the new argument, that it's no longer a question of what Iran has. It's a question of what Iran's intentions are. And this, of course, for the poor Iranians, is an unanswerable question. How do you answer your intentions?
It's supposed to be a Kentucky. Now, it's interesting when those people who have advised caution on this and recall the mad mutually assured destruction that kept the U.S. and the Soviet Union from attacking each other with nuclear weapons over the Cold War, say this would be certainly the same situation with Iran, because the Iranians know that should they launch a nuclear attack, should they even have nuclear weapons, it would they would be blown up in nuclear war. As a matter of fact, Hillary Clinton said, "We would. What would the U.S. response to be to an Israeli Israel being attacked by Iran with nuclear weapons?" And she said, "We would obliterate them." Now, it's interesting, nobody has asked Hillary Clinton what she would do if Israel attacked Iran with tactical nuclear weapons. That question never gets asked.
That's right, and obviously the likelihood in the current scenario is that Israel is going to be attacking Iran, not vice versa. Iran has not attacked anyone since a war it had with the Ottoman Empire in the 17th century.
It's also interesting that we keep seeing in the media misquotations of Ahmadinejad, who is not, I'm not a fan of his at all. I think he's his statements have not helped the situation. But he has been quoted as repeatedly saying we're going to wipe Israel off the map, and he hasn't said this. But almost every week you have some Israeli military official or government official threatening a war in Iran, and this doesn't seem to be a problem.
Yeah, well, that's the old hypocrisy in the system, that the anything the Israelis do is because they're a beleaguered little democracy in the Middle East, and anything anybody else does is because they're nasty.
Well, and another thing I pointed out, you wrote that they talk about the Iranian, this Iranian regime is not like the Russians, because the Russians were actually rational. But I don't think anybody was saying that during the Cold War, but they're saying this Iranian regime with the mullahs is irrational. But as you write, if there's any party that's irrational these days, it's the government of Israel.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, when you look at basically what Bibi Netanyahu and his foreign minister Avigdor Lieberman say on a regular basis, you have to question their sanity. And you know, and there's I pointed out in one of the articles that I think there's a considerable measure of hubris about this too, that the Israeli leadership believes they're racially superior to their neighbors, and they also probably believe they're racially superior to Americans. And they believe that they can control the situation in Washington through their friends in the media and in Congress. And to a certain extent, they've been right up till now. But this kind of arrogance leads to making very bad decisions.
Well, the situation with Congress, of course, is deplorable. I have a brochure from AIPAC in 1988, when I briefly joined to see what it was all about, in which it's a colorful brochure with a chronology that brags how Congress, Israel, has or AIPAC has been able to get Congress to stand up against the President and the State Department over a period of years. And it is Congress that is Israel's great friend. And this is an extraordinary message, if it would, the American people would understand that. I think, from my own experience, that the support for the American people of Israel is fairly thin. I remember when George Bush the First, say George Senior, made his press conference in 1991 criticizing Israel lobbyists who were trying to get the loan guarantee, 10 billion loan guarantees. A poll showed afterward that 85% of the American public was standing with him, and I noticed Jane Harman, who you've also written about, I want to talk about briefly, a woman running for Congress or re-election in Southern California, who's a big supporter of AIPAC and very close to Israel. On her website, she mentions nothing at all about her support for Israel, which makes me think that there's a bit of a myth about how much the Americans actually do support Israel. Maybe you could talk for a moment about Jane Harman and her... the way she was handled with kid gloves after she was being taped by the NSA, talking to an Israeli agent about how trying to help two AIPAC officials get out of an indictment.
Yeah, well, basically, Jane was indeed taped while she was talking to an Israeli intelligence officer, and she essentially committed to doing what she could to help Rosen and Weissman, the two AIPAC officials that were at that time on trial. And in return for that, the Israeli offered to use his influence and the Israeli influence to get Jane the position of chairman of the House Committee on Intelligence. Very important, very senior position. So that was the quid pro quo. In spite of the fact she was taped, absolutely nothing ever happened. She was not punished in any way. She was not investigated in any way. She's still sitting on Capitol Hill. She's being challenged by a very good candidate, Marcy Winograd, in California, and I hope to hell that Marcy beats her.
Well, I should tell listeners, if you go to the Counterpunch website on Monday, I have an article about the Harman-Winograd race on the Counterpunch website, counterpunch.org. We're going to go to the phones because the phones are ringing off the hook here. So let's go to the first caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning, Jeff. Good morning, Phil.
Morning.
I look forward to your articles every week. I would like to bring up a little bit of an off-topic thing, but it does tie into what you're talking about this morning. I recently read a rather long article about the ongoing case of the former FBI translator, Sybil Edmonds, who has been making charges for years that she uncovered evidence while listening to surveillance tapes of really extraordinary corruption that reached right up to the Speaker of the House, most of it having to do with the government of Turkey. And we're talking about suitcases full of cash, honey traps, sexual blackmail, all sorts of things. And towards the end of the article, you were quoted as saying, this is so explosive and reaches into so many levels of the government that nobody wants to touch it. Could you talk a little bit about that? And do you see a parallel between that corruption and the pressure being brought to bear, not just politically, but also possibly with illegal activities by the Israel lobby? Thank you very much.
Thank you for your call and your kind words. Obviously, Sibel has been talking a lot about mostly Turkey, but the Israeli lobby has traditionally been tied in with Turkey. So a lot of these activities are transnational, if you want to refer to it that way. I have felt that Sibel certainly deserves her day in court. She's made some very specific allegations about individuals by name and with a lot of corroborating detail. And I think that she certainly deserves a hearing. But the problem is every time she approaches Congress or she approaches the media, they're afraid to touch it for the usual reasons. They don't want to get entangled with the Israeli lobby. They don't want to get entangled with the whole issue of corruption in Washington. And for this reason, basically her story has been too much of a hot potato. I am fearful that the story, if anything, now has waned a bit, and we won't see any action on it. But, it doesn't take much to figure out that the corruption in Washington is pervasive, and it's bipartisan. And the fact that it's bipartisan is the reason why nobody can go near it, because when the Republicans are in power, they don't want to talk about it. The Democrats are in power, they don't want to talk about it either.
Well, thank you. I interviewed you actually 2 years ago. We did talk about the Sibel Edmonds case. There was a different Turkish government at that time when she was doing that work. And this new Turkish government is presenting serious problems for both Washington and Israel. And maybe you could talk about that. I know the Turkish government is supporting a Turkish charity that is sending a boatload of construction materials to Gaza next month, or later this month, actually. And if Israel would do something that would be considered aggressive toward the Turkish boat, attack it. I mentioned to my listeners, could Turkey call in their NATO allies as the U.S. did in Afghanistan?
It would be kind of interesting, wouldn't it?
I suspect that they might even be thinking about that in Tel Aviv and Washington, because right now the Turkish-Israeli relationship seems to be lower than it's ever been, and this has been a critical relationship both for the U.S. as well as Israel. Maybe you could talk about that for a moment.
Well, the Turkish and Israeli relationship is a kind of a three-way relationship, because the U.S. is, as you indicate, the silent partner in it. Turkey gets favorable treatment from the United States because it's good to Israel. Israel gets a place to sell some weapons. They both benefit in a number of ways. But let's face it, the relationship has been a government-to-government-to-government relationship. Defense ministries, Pentagon, people like that, defense contractors. Israel is, in fact, extremely unpopular in Turkey. And the government of Turkey is now reflecting that reality. That on Turkish television during the invasion of Gaza last year, it was showing nightly people being slaughtered by Israeli forces. So, the Turks have no love for this relationship, and now the Turkish government is finally more coming into line with what the Turkish people really want. It shows that, politics is a funny thing, and, this kind of thing maybe could happen even in the United States.
It's interesting, actually, that the Turkish government is criticized because they're responsive to public opinion. I remember during the beginning of the war of Iraq when Turkey refused to let the U.S. participate or use its bases, and there was a 96% poll in Turkey against the Turkish government allowing the U.S. to use the base. Paul Wolfowitz, the great promoter of democracy, criticized Turkey for responding to the streets. But it's interesting that they're doing it today. One of the things, while I mentioned that, the myths that we have is that the neocons actually seriously wanted to democratize the Middle East.
Well, no, they didn't, obviously. They wanted to create a Middle East that was controllable from their point of view, which was basically an Israel-centric point of view. And that's clearly what they were doing. They could care less about democracy in Iraq or democracy in Iran or democracy anywhere else.
Or the United States.
Or the United States, for that matter. That's right.
We have another caller on the phone. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
Given what your guest has stated, I wonder if you can, if your guest could talk a bit about just how deeply has American national security been penetrated by Israeli agents. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Well, that's a good question. We don't really have enough time to get to it. I would think that the answer is that American security has been massively penetrated by the Israelis. One of the key ways in which they've done it, which I will discuss a little bit, is through communications and their ability to tap into telephones and data lines and that kind of thing. A lot of the companies that do security for phone systems are Israeli, and they're headquartered in Israel, and yet they operate here in the United States under in corporations of companies here, but they're still run out of Israel. And Israelis have spies all over the place. They have spies certainly in the Defense Department, many of whom came in when Wolfowitz and Pearl and Doug Feith and others were in control at the Pentagon. So I would say it's a massive issue. I did a story for the American Conservative last year in which I described Israeli spying, and if you go on the Internet, you'll find it. I think you should maybe look at that, and you'll get probably a better background for it.
I was blown away by it.
Never read anything. This whole issue of... you have articles on the Internet. Have you made any effort, or have you given up trying to get an op-ed in one of the major papers, or does John Bolton always preempt you?
It would have to. John Bolton, Doug Feith, there's a whole bunch of people that are in line ahead of me. I've been blackballed at the New York Times and the Washington Post when I even try to electronically post a letter to the editor, and my IP address is blocked. I don't know. It's not a really receptive place for me to post things.
I can make them see. To what extent does the media play a role in this, and how can we combat it aside from the Internet, which is a godsend in this sense?
Well, I think whenever I talk about what the major impediments are to straightening out our foreign policy, I always couple Congress and the media. I think they're equal players in this. The media basically shapes the narrative that most people in the United States hear. And if you're constantly shaping a narrative in a pro-Israeli direction, that's what people believe to be true. So I think that the media is absolutely culpable in all of this. I don't know what we can do to fix it. The media, basically, the people who are the editors-in-chief are all pro-Israeli in one sense or another, or are afraid to take on the issue. And unless somebody among your listeners has the money to go out and buy a major news outlet and have it start telling the truth, I'm not quite sure what we can do.
I didn't give the number here. People already know. Some of them know it. It's 895-2448, 895-2448, 1-800-499-7117. There's an interesting long bio of Chaim Saban, the leading donor to the Democratic Party, also an open Israeli firster. He actually is an Israeli, became Israeli-American, and given more money to the Democratic Party, including the billions to build their building. He's in the market for more media. He might even buy Newsweek now, which is for sale.
That's right. Yep. And he also, of course, controls Brookings, which used to be a fairly reasonable think tank, that now it's the there's the Saban Institute at Brookings that's headed by Indyk, isn't it?
Exactly. It was the last independent think tank, and he set up this. He paid the $12.3 million to set this think tank, is the Saban Institute up there. It's an extraordinary story, and it's not a secret. That's the problem.
Yeah, well, they don't have to act in secret because basically they get away with it.
There's simply no outrage. One thing, getting back, bringing it to a close here, you said the one thing that might stop an attack on Iran is the President of the United States going before the American public like Eisenhower once did back in 1956, and like President Bush Sr. did in 1991. Do you think there's any chance of President Obama actually going to the American people telling them the truth?
No. I think that Obama basically has no leverage over Israel right now. He knows that. And I said in my article that the only thing I could see that would be effective is if he were to get up and publicly appeal to the U.S. people and say, look, Iran is not a threat. If Israel attacks Iran, it would not be in our interest and would damage our interest and threaten our troops. Therefore, we're telling Israel that if they attack Iran, we will disavow it, and we will further go and take steps in the United Nations to punish them. But no, I don't see it happening.
Well, Philip Giraldi, I want to thank you very much for being here. I guess you can read his articles on... you have your own website.
No, I don't. No,
but on antiwar.com, you will find articles and then references to his other articles. And so thanks very much for being our guest again today. It was great talking to you.
Thank you, Jeff.
Take care. Keep up the fight. Bye-bye.